Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Happy New Year, and thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Our first show of the new year opens with a visit from former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Regina Benjamin with an important reminder to adults age 65 and older, especially African-American adults, to recognize the risk and about getting their required vaccinations. Then we'll replay a segment from mid-November about the Community Fund for Women and Girls, the second oldest women's endowment in the state. And we'll key in on eight regional programs receiving new grant funding in this, its 20th anniversary year. Then we'll wrap up focusing on another round of grants, this time going to protect and preserve the pristine resource we call Long Island Sound. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. AARP Connecticut is seeking to facilitate discussions with state residents and local civic and community organizations about the growing retirement savings gap and what's being done here in Connecticut and across the country to address it. AARP volunteers are available to present Work and Save, How Secure Is Your Financial Future?, a new 30 to 45 minute interactive presentation that can help individuals think about what they want their future to look like and what they'll need to achieve it. To learn more or to request a free presentation for your group, email ctaarp@aarp.org and reference Work and Save in the subject line. Or you can call toll free 866-295-7279. Our very special guest this morning is Dr. Regina M. Benjamin. She served as the 18th United States Surgeon General under President Barack Obama, and during this time she also served as the first chair of the National Prevention, Health Promotion, and Public Health Council, also known as the National Prevention Council. And we are pleased to welcome her here today to talk about a very important subject. We have talked many times on this program with experts, particularly, and even as recently as last week, about some of the acute health risks that African Americans may be subject to, that may be a little bit more prominent with African Americans than others. But we have not yet touched upon the subject of pneumonia. So we're welcoming Dr. Benjamin here to talk a little bit about that today. Dr. Benjamin, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about what of all of the health risks that African-Americans are subject to, why now and why pneumonia?
Well, as you mentioned, prevention has been the foundation of my work as a family physician and as Surgeon General. And so today I want to talk about preventing older Americans from getting pneumococcal pneumonia. And so I've teamed up with Pfizer to help to increase awareness about the importance of adult vaccination.
Okay, well, let's roll back just a moment. When I use the sort of common term pneumonia, does that specifically mean pneumococcal pneumonia, or are there other kinds?
There are others. Pneumonia is simply an infection in the lung. It can be any kind of infection, and it's often caused by a germ, either a virus or a bacteria or some other type of pneumonia. I mean, you can all types of pneumonia. But pneumococcal pneumonia is a specific bacteria that causes a very serious serious pneumonia.
Life-threatening.
It can be life-threatening. It doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. But people, Americans who are 65 and older, are at high risk simply because as we get older, our body's immune system tends to decrease, making us higher risk. And so with pneumococcal pneumonia, anybody can get it, but it's more risky for an older American. Mm-hmm. Because of that decreased immunity in our body.
So then I'm gathering that some of the other health concerns that are more predominant in the African American community are compounding the danger of one contracting pneumococcal pneumonia.
Correct. As African Americans, we are more likely to have chronic illnesses like diabetes and hypertension and heart disease, and those will also increase our risk for getting pneumonia and serious types of pneumonia. Mm-hmm. And so it's important that we raise awareness, and that's why I've teamed up with Pfizer to raise that awareness about the importance of adult vaccinations. We know a lot about children's vaccination. We hear about it all the time, but we tend to forget that adults need to be vaccinated as well. And that's why this campaign to raise awareness.
Mm. Is there some idea that there's a disparity in access to education or promotion for adult vaccines in the African American community versus the Caucasian community or other groups?
We know about health disparities. We have research going on all over this country. In fact, NIH has an entire institute devoted to health disparities, and we're trying to figure out why. But we know that they exist. I mentioned to you about the chronic illnesses, chronic diseases within the African-American community.
Mm.
In spite of all that, the science shows that African-American adults over the age of 65 have lower rates of vaccinations than their white counterparts.
Mm.
And as in general, if you ask about preventive services amongst African Americans, those rates are also lower of just receiving preventive services. So it's more of, at this point, we want to try to increase awareness to make sure people know why it's important that you get vaccinated, that the adults get their vaccinations, as well as, you know, children and others that are at risk. But we don't tend to think of ourselves as older Americans to that we need to be vaccinated too.
Mm. Do you have the idea that messaging about adult vaccinations is being less exposed in the African American community?
I hope not, and I hope as we have shows like today that it will get out there and have people talking about it and communicating a lot about it more. Anything that you can do to prevent an illness is worthwhile.
Mm.
I always say prevention. Things you can do in it, you know, is make sure all of your vaccinations are up to date. But also you can make sure you wash your hands frequently. Just frequent washing your hands, live a healthy lifestyle, eat well, exercise. That helps build up your immunity as well and make you able to fight off any kind of infection. So all of those things go hand in hand. But I would encourage everyone to talk to their doctor. Talk to your doctor about your status and talk to them about where you are and to make sure that you're up to date on all of your adult vaccinations.
Excellent. We're talking with Dr. Regina Benjamin. You recognize her name because she was the 18th U.S. Surgeon General. And we're talking about pneumococcal pneumonia vaccinations specifically, particularly for the African American community. So, Dr. Benjamin, here we are, holiday time, probably among, if not at the point in the year when most families and friends get together to socialize. So it seems like a perfect time for anybody who's hearing this program to kind of make a mental note of it, to just kind of mention maybe if they're visiting with their adult or older relatives during the holiday period.
That's correct. Anybody can get pneumonia, but those who are at higher risk or any kind of weakness in their immunity or even are more high risk, the worst thing you could ever experience is the fact that you or your loved one were to get sick, go in the hospital, and die of an illness that could have been prevented.
Mm.
And that's why I would say wash your hands. Make sure you not only get your vaccinations, but that you make sure your loved ones get theirs too.
Well, you have a very interesting professional history, coming up in the more of a kind of a public health arena that you served. Either in your history or during your service as U.S. Surgeon General or since, are you hearing rumors or are you disturbed to hear that people are still under great misconceptions about adult vaccinations, like we had that scare and that sort of trend a year or two ago about childhood vaccinations? Are there fears among the adult community still that linger, or stigmas about adult vaccinations, like this critically important pneumococcal pneumonia vaccine that you're promoting?
Well, I think there are two things. One is what we see with the childhood vaccinations is a little bit different than the older ones, and then the other is I'll talk about men. But the first one is that most of the adults 65 and older remember the measles. They remember the whooping cough. The younger parents who are being resistant to vaccinations never saw these. They didn't see these illnesses. There's nothing like seeing your child with a whooping cough who can't catch their breath, breathing in, and can't get their breath. You would do anything to give your child the ability to breathe. They've not seen that. And we have illnesses that we had when I was a child that don't exist in society anymore. Mm. Yeah. You don't even have to get smallpox vaccine.
Oh, yeah, and I had scarlet fever in 1961.
You don't see those much anymore. And so these younger parents haven't seen it. And so it's more of an intellectual conversation than they have than an experience. Mm. When we get to older Americans, I think some of them remember those. And so that's not the resistance that we see. I see resistance from people who just don't like to go to the doctor. Men, particularly, no offense to half of the population, but they tend not to like to come in. And so I always tell them, treat your body like you treat your car. You know, you would not think of letting your car go 40, 50 years without a tune-up or an oil change. Mm. You should at least treat your body as good as you treat your car. Go in and get your maintenance. Go in and get your vaccinations and your blood pressure checked so that vehicle can carry you through later years in life.
And I guess probably one of the best things that we've got going today is the proliferation of sites where individuals can get vaccines. I mean, even if an adult or an older African-American adult doesn't have a regular doctor or doesn't like to go to the doctor, there is a broadening opportunity of sites to go to get the shot.
Yes, I would encourage everyone to find a medical home. You know, I'm a family physician, so I want to push that's important because your medical home, they know you, they know who you are. But if you don't, or even if you do, we've tried to make it as convenient as possible. If you remember, the Affordable Care Act requires now that preventive services are offered, and they're offered at no copay, without a copay, for Medicare and for all insurances. And so those are there. We're trying to make it as easy as accessible as possible. You can go to your corner drugstore, and often they'll have a nurse practitioner or physician assistant there to you can get your immunizations there. You can come to the your own doctor's office, and some you don't even have to make an appointment most of the time in your doctor's office, and they'll get you your vaccinations. We're trying to make it as easy as possible for you to get immunized.
So I guess when most people think of the flu vaccination, they think of a little bit of active flu or influenza actually in the vaccine. For the purpose of education, what is actually in the pneumococcal pneumonia vaccine that then spurs prevention of getting that illness?
So two things. One is the flu is a virus, and so it's an attenuated virus vaccination. Pneumococcal is a bacteria. It's a germ that, you know, a bacteria. And so those are the two scientific differences. And all of them are different. I mean, there's so many new technologies and ways to deliver the immunizations that you'd have to talk to your doctor to know which one. Mm-hmm. Whether it's live or not, the whole idea about a vaccination is to give you just a little bit of the protein that's in either the bacteria or the virus, whether it's live or not, just a little bit of it to trick your body to think you've had the disease. And so then it builds up an immunity against it, so next time you don't get it. So that's the whole purpose behind a vaccination, is to build up that army to fight it if you should get it.
Excellent. Our guest this morning was the 18th U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Regina Benjamin, and she's on board this morning to help African-Americans in our listening audience, African-American adults and their families, understand that aging, as well as chronic conditions like diabetes and COPD and others, can increase their personal risk for serious infectious diseases like pneumococcal pneumonia. And she's urging African-American adults, especially those 65 and older, to take steps to help protect themselves. And also for anyone listening who's getting together with older African-American adults, particularly your older adults this holiday season, make sure that they get their pneumococcal pneumonia vaccine. Dr. Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us.
I would like to just add one brief thing.
Please.
You can go to a website, knowpneumonia.com, K-N-O-W-P-N-E-U-M-O-N-I-A, and you can learn a lot more information about pneumonia and how to prevent it.
KnowPneumonia.com. Great and wise advice from the 18th U.S. Surgeon General. Dr. Benjamin, great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning, and happy holidays to you.
Thank you, and to you too.
So a little over a month ago, or around a month ago, on October 30th, at the 20th anniversary celebration of luncheon, the Community Fund for Women and Girls, Greater New Haven's permanent charitable endowment dedicated solely to advancing women and girls, announced that it has awarded $203,000+ in grants to 8 nonprofit organizations serving women and girls in Greater New Haven and the Naugatuck Valley area. We are pleased to welcome to the program this morning another new friend from the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven. We're talking with Sharon Capetta. She's Director of Development and lead staff for the Community Fund for Women and Girls, as we chatted just a few minutes before we went on the air. Sharon indicated that she's been involved with the fund for a little over a dozen years of its 20 years of existence. So we want to find all about it and celebrate the those agencies and programs that were awarded through this initiative. Sharon, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, John. Thank you for having us.
So just give us a little bit of history and perspective. First of all, a little bit about the mission of the Community Foundation and its desire to impact resources for philanthropy and kind of enhancing the knowledge of and practice of philanthropy in your service area?
Oh, great question. Yeah, the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven is one of the older community foundations in the country, and there are over 600 community foundations in our country. And it's a public charitable endowment, and it's composed of individuals and create charitable funds, typically through requests or active giving, and they create funds to carry out their philanthropic wishes and intent. And they charge the Community Foundation with honoring that intent forever. So that's really the focus on the fund side of honoring the donor's intent. The Fund for Women and Girls, which is also a component fund of the Community Foundation, is a collective one. 20 years ago, a woman came to the Community Foundation and said she wanted to do something to help women and girls and children, and what might work for that purpose. And at the time, women's funds, collective endowment funds, were being created across the country. So she had the option of making it a collective effort or simply creating her own fund and making recommendations for grants herself. And she opted for the collective model, and the Fund for Women and Girls was born. So the fund itself is governed by an advisory board of women who determine strategy, purpose, focus, that type of thing. And the grants are recommended by committee And then approved ultimately by the Community Foundation Board of Directors.
So for the, you know, two or three times a year, we check in with community foundations, including the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven and the Valley Community Foundation. We hear about how the power of many underwrites initiatives, most of the time ongoing. What I found really special about your explanation and what I know of the Fund for Women and Girls is it really reinforces the fact that one person's philanthropy can plant a seed that really can begin to make a substantial difference, not just in one community, but an entire region or even perhaps statewide. And this Fund for Women and Girls is certainly evidence of, you know, how one person's effort can really make a long-term difference.
It's funny. It's wonderful that you've picked up on that. And in working on this 20th anniversary, spent a lot of time. There were two women and a small group of women who said, yeah, let's create this collective fund. Let's build it together. And they set a goal to raise $10,000. And they hoped that 10 women would make a commitment of $1,000 to be paid over 4 years to get this fledgling fund off the ground. And in 1995, $1,000 was a large commitment. And they were delighted when they did not only 10,000, not only 10 women came forward and said, yes, I'm in. Actually, 92 women said, I'm in, count me in.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an incredible response to this idea that an endowment fund, growing an endowment fund, stepping forward and saying, this is a priority, a philanthropic priority. Advancing women and girls is important, and count me in. And so this starting 20 years ago, this power of many, as you mentioned. And in the early years of the fund, I mean, the first grant awards from the fund in 1996 totaled $1,500. But none of the people around the table were in the habit of writing $1,500 checks for philanthropy, for directed to organizations. And it was delightful and really a privilege to sit with the founding members and share with them that in the 20th year, the fund would commit over $200,000 in grants that year. So tremendous trajectory of growth because of the many, many people that have supported it over the years.
Yeah, the other cool thing is that it reminds people that if they have a particular passion or a particular concern, even a highly niche concern, I mean, if you want to start a fund that's potentially going to target, Native American children who live in the urban New Haven region who are having, issues with dyslexia or autism, you could potentially go to the Community Foundation and work to try to establish that highly niche initiative, and then perhaps align some of your friends or colleagues around it to start the ball rolling, just like this fund. So anybody who has a dream about carrying on their passion long after they are gone has an opportunity to do that with the foundation.
Yeah, that's true. The value of the Community Foundation is helping people think today about their philanthropic intent 50 or 100 years from now. And my favorite example is a fund that was established in the 50s, the late 40s, early 50s, for the provision of milk and coal for the poor among us. And so if the intent over time, certainly coal is no longer used for heating, and the milk delivery system through the public schools and the federal programs is such that when the fund was created, kids didn't have milk and people didn't have coal to heat with. In the contemporary version, those funds are used to provide what we call basic needs, so the heating and energy assistance programs that are done through various organizations in the region, and the food distribution programs as well. So that's the beauty of the Community Foundation, is that 60, 80, 100 years from now, that intent, that provision of basic needs for the poor among us is being met. It allows it to stay contemporary.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that is not beyond the reach of virtually anyone. I think a lot of times people are confused or aren't aware that, you know, even if they have a very nominal amount to invest, or if they've decided I'm going to spend $100 or $1,000 a year and I want to make it quick and easy. I want it to go one place and I want it to know that it's going to work well for the community or toward my passion, and I'd like an opportunity for that money to perhaps grow in concert with other like-minded donors. It doesn't have to be $1 million or $100,000 or even $10,000. It can be a quite a nominal sum, and I know that represents perhaps a growing segment of the donors to the Community Foundation.
Yeah, you could say that, as you mentioned before, with these the power of many. So, reaching together, gathering together, and pooling resources in these collective funds, like the Fund for Women and Girls, allows a more modest donor to have great impact, to share in the great impact.
Mm. That's great. We're going to also talk about how some of the recipients of this year's Fund for Women and Girls grants actually are working together to make their initiative stronger. We're pleased to be joined this morning by representative of the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven, Sharon Capetta, Director of Development and Lead Staff for the Community Fund for Women and Girls. We're going to come back after a brief break and drill into celebrating some of all of the 8 recipients of this year's grants. If you'll stick with us through the break, we'll be right back. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to our award-winning New Year's show for the people right after this news. People with differing abilities have hopes and dreams just like everybody else. The Sarah Family of Agencies is dedicated to helping fulfill these hopes and dreams by providing programs and services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities who live in Connecticut. There are many ways in which you can support their nonprofit by attending special events, donating a used car, visiting Sarah's Cupboard Thrift Shop in Brantford, and, of course, through direct donations. Learn more at sarahfoundation.org. That's S-A-R-A-H foundation.org. Thanks for sticking with us. We're back with Sharon Capetta. She represents the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven this morning. She is a director of development and lead staff for the Community Fund for Women and Girls. As we said before, Sharon joined us at its 20th anniversary celebration in late October. The Fund for Women and Girls and the Greater awarded $203,740 in grants to 8 nonprofit organizations serving women and girls in Greater New Haven and the Naugatuck Valley. So, Sharon, the first thing I want to talk about is something that was kind of pulled out by one of the fund's advisory board members, Nancy Yao Mosbach, indicating how proud she was that not only were these grants going to good causes in some cases, or perhaps all of them, they were going to causes that have some interconnectivity or cooperative nature. Can we talk a little bit about that before we reveal the 8 grant recipients?
Sure. The Fund for Women and Girls looks at the all of the partners, if you will. We the advisory board and grants committee, view the nonprofit organizations as partners in this work, and they're all connected by the link to gender, in that they are all looking to provide programming and services that will promote the social and economic advancement of women and girls. So that's the mission of the fund. And working at this in a very thoughtful way, and we are delighted to have partnership with many, many organizations in the region that are thinking about issues and opportunities for women and girls.
Excellent. And I'm pleased that at least seven of the eight of this year's recipients have either been one time or even repetitive guests on the award-winning For the People with me, or we've certainly talked about them and helped promote them through public service announcements. So let's introduce the 2015 grant recipients for the Fund for Women and Girls, starting with the big money, the $160,000 signature grant going to All Our Kin. Let's hear about that organization.
Well, All Our Kin is a truly terrific organization that works with family child care providers. And family child care providers are doing the bulk of child care provision. And All Our Kin focuses actually on areas that where you're working with what you call, say, an underserved population. So they are increasing and improving the quality, the amount of child care available, the quality of the child care available, and they, in the process, are developing women business entrepreneurs as family child care providers. So we've been delighted to work with All Our Kin over the years, over 12 years actually, on the in the growth and development of their organization. This grant specifically is to provide one-on-one coaching and consultation around the business aspect of being a family child care provider. And they have done evaluation of their program, and the economic impact is just, it's truly amazing how family child care providers who are involved with All Our Kin and members of their network advance their businesses, the quality of the care that they're providing, and the continuity. And it's also important. We've well documented the link between early care and education and later outcomes and achievement in life. So people are able to have their children in a quality, loving, successful, consistent child care provider as a result. So it just works on so many levels.
Mm. We talk a lot about the Girl Scouts of Connecticut. They were a $5,000 grantee. And what's exciting about just this kind of nominal grant to this organization is that it is going to go toward establishing a pilot program.
Yeah, the Girl Scouts of Connecticut, which covers the whole state now, had started doing a little bit of work in Bridgeport in working to ensure that girls have access to troops. And of course, dynamics and demographics are changing in our world, so they're testing different ways to ensure that troops are available, particularly in some of our more concentrated urban areas. So we're delighted that they are piloting their program in New Haven, and we look forward to a successful report with them and see how we can continue that work. We all know that Girl Scouting is important.
And this is evidence of the kind of crossover effect, because that pilot program is going to be initiated in partnership with the Boys and Girls Club of New Haven, themselves a $10,000 grantee. And once again, to evidence that kind of community spirit, the $10,000 for the Boys and Girls Club of New Haven separately is going to support a new program called Ascend, which is being promoted in cooperation with Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The Boys and Girls Club is another organization that we are just truly privileged to partner with. And specifically, interested in and delighted that they continue to find ways to, you know, in addition to the Boys and Girls Club's fully vetted programming, the partnership and mentorship opportunities with the AKAs, the Alpha Kappa Alpha, which is an African-American women's sorority, really just, you know, imagine that you're a 12-year-old girl and you have the chance to partner with and learn from and develop a career and college readiness information with a practiced, real life, if you can see it, you can be it, woman who is in the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. So it just really makes complete sense.
Excellent. Our friends at the Connecticut Women's Education and Legal Fund were a $2,500 recipient at the end of October for this event. And this is focusing on an important initiative that we can't talk enough about, and that is reinforcing STEM education, especially for girls and women.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's interesting because Guelph, we affectionately refer to the Connecticut Women's Education and Legal Fund as Guelph. You wouldn't think from their name, the Education and Legal Fund, that they would be so actively working on STEM programming, but they actually do tremendous work all around the state in partnership with institutions such as Gateway. So we're delighted to support their work.
Yeah. And another recipient also focusing on STEM education, this time in kind of a more fun way, a girls-only summer program, are our friends at LEAP, who received $10,000. So this sounds like a lot of fun for girls ages 7 to 12 and a great way to perhaps reveal to them a future career in one of the STEM disciplines.
Exactly. We were delighted when the local paper carried a front page story entitled Girls Code, because it was about coding also the swimming piece, making sure that the girls know how to swim is really important. But the coding and making it fun and planting that seed that you can do that too, mm-hmm. Is again, it marries well with the Boys and Girls Club program. If you can see it, you can be it. And having the opportunity to do that in an environment full of other girls is truly something that we look to support.
Great. Two other organizations now, as the spotlight swings toward Milford, are some spectacular initiatives, both who have been frequent guests or been frequently promoted on For the People over many years. Literacy Center of Milford receiving $5,000 specifically to support an adult women's English as a second language program and mother's advanced class serving immigrant women in the community. And the Young Parent Program, which focuses on ensuring teens and young adults who are expecting can attend childbirth classes and get positive pregnancy counseling. And it carries on after the baby is born with support to ensure that family grows in a great way. Both great organizations, the Young Parent Program receiving $2,500 for their efforts. And last but not least, the final awardee for the Women and Girls Fund this year, Pequeñas Ligas Hispanas de New Haven, who received the curiously not round figure of $8,740. It sounds like an invoice was presented. What's going on with this one?
Pequeñas Ligas is really the fundamentals of sports and with a focus on girls is really important, but it's also about college readiness and enhancing the attractiveness of Latina candidates for college admission. So it's a very interesting program and very detailed. So that's the $8,740.
Excellent. That they could,
a very precise application.
They could pin it down. Hey, and that makes it easier on the grantors to know they're targeting the exact amount of money that's needed for the program. So that's great.
Yeah.
Well, we thank you for being with us this morning. It was great to be able to chat about this fantastic initiative. Sharon Capetta, Director of Development and Lead Staff for the Community Fund for Women and Girls, is with us. That program is a component of the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven and the second oldest women's endowment in the state of Connecticut. To date, it has awarded approximately $1 million to support more than 200 programs since its establishment 20 years ago. If you're interested in finding out more about this or other initiatives of the foundation, you can always go to fundforwomenandgirls.org or visit cfgnh.org for the larger community foundation programs, which are always happening. We thank you for filling us in on this latest round of grants for the Fund for Women and Girls, and wish you good luck and a happy holiday, Sharon. Well, we like to dig into some subject matter on the environment, and long-term listeners to the program know that we frequently talk about Long Island Sound, because if you're visiting it occasionally over the summer or taking a nice winter or spring walk along the beach, looking out across the Sound from Connecticut toward Long Island, it may not occur to you that Long Island Sound is actually a small environmental engine that is critical to the entire global environmental infrastructure. We've learned a lot about that from our friends at the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and we're so pleased to bring on the program this morning Amanda Basso. She's director for the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation here in the Northeast region. The reason we're bringing Amanda onto the program is about a month ago, top federal and state environmental officials announced 22 grants totaling more than $1.3 million to local government and community groups here in Connecticut and over in New York to improve the health and ecosystem of Long Island Sound. So, Amanda, thanks for joining us. Happy holidays. Hope everything's going well for you.
You bet, and thanks to you as well.
So let's take this from the broad view and then drill into some of the specific projects here in Connecticut. First of all, the $1.3 million that was awarded back in mid-November, is that something of a reoccurring program that's an annual type of allocation, or was this something that was specific and unique?
No, it's an annual program. It's called the Long Island Sound Futures Fund, and we administer an annual competitive grant program in partnership with the Long Island Sound Study, the federal-state partnership to clean up Long Island Sound. And the funding comes primarily from the Environmental Protection Agency and also from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So, you know, we issue a competitive solicitation asking for good project ideas in some targeted geographies and doing some specific activities, and then community groups and nonprofit organizations put in proposals, and then we vet them with experts and select the best of the best.
So for folks that may not be familiar with that process, the bottom line is that everyone applying for these grants already knows and is committed to making their own investment to match some of these funds to bring even greater potency to these projects.
That's right. So we awarded $1.3 million in grant funding, and then the awardees, the folks that are doing the on-the-ground work, brought an additional $2.1 million to those projects in either cash funds they've raised from others or in their own resources in terms of supplies and staff time and that kind of thing. So altogether, we're looking at $3.4 million of impact on the ground for the benefit of Long Island Sound.
Hmm. Is that roughly the amount that's allocated every year, around, you know, around a million somewhere? Or is it?
Yeah, about that. We, you know, we're always trying to grow the pot. We are a working foundation that raises funds as well as giving away money. So there's some variation, but it's generally in the million to $1.5 million range.
So looking back over the history of this Long Island Sound Futures Fund, let's talk a little bit about some of the successes that you have seen, and perhaps that even residents who are somewhat you know, disinterested or at least not really, you know, focusing on some of the improvements or changes in Long Island Sound. Let's talk a little bit about some of the great work you've done up to now.
Sure. So the Long Island Sound Futures Fund has been awarding these grants since 2005, and all told, we've awarded about $14.3 million, and that's over 300 projects. And they you know, run the gamut from dam removals and culvert replacements to make sure that fish can access streams, to shoreline restoration work, a lot of actually activities to improve how the land handles runoff from our urban environment so that, you know, rain isn't washing pollution off the streets, but instead is actually putting it in urban wetlands and that kind of thing. So a lot of different kinds of activities. And then this program also has a big focus on engaging people in conservation and environmental education. So a lot of projects actually engage especially kids in doing a lot of the on-the-ground work in terms of tree planting and beach cleanups and that kind of thing. So let's see, since 2005, I think we've some of the outcomes we've achieved, we've reopened 157 miles of streams to fish. Hmm. So that that's habitat that was cut off because either a culvert can be, if culverts that that we put under roads are undersized, then there's too much water flowing through and the fish can't actually get upstream. Mm-hmm. And then also some of these small dams that we put in for, you know, flood control. Yeah. Or all sorts of, or some of them are historic for historic industrial activities and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
By removing them, we actually provide access, and a lot of times that upstream rivers are actually in a lot better shape than the downstream ones, so we're providing access to, in a lot of cases, pretty high-quality habitat upstream.
So let's stop you right there and dig into that, because when people are hearing, wow, $1 million, $1.5 million a year, and it's about getting, you know, in part, getting fish upstream. So let's talk a little bit about why that is so important to the health of, I guess, not only Long Island Sound, but the water courses through which these fish can now pass and move upstream.
Sure. So the program has a large focus on improving the water in Long Island Sound. So we want to make sure that the water in Long Island Sound itself is clean. But a lot of the things that a lot of the fish and wildlife that rely on Long Island Sound and actually even generally live in the sound, also there are a lot of fish that use those freshwater systems, the rivers and streams, to go upstream and spawn. And if they can't get upstream and spawn, then you're not going to have the next year's young that are going to populate Long Island Sound. So a lot of the it's a whole system sort of approach.
Right.
You want to improve the water quality, but you've got to also make sure that the whole system is functioning to deliver the clean water, but also the habitat.
Right. Each of these fish is a little patch in a massive patchwork quilt that, you know, the more holes you have in it, the less effective it is. I guess that's maybe oversimplifying it, but also there's got to be an economic benefit to this too. Don't Long Islanders and Connecticut residents and recreational sports enthusiasts also don't they go out and they catch these fish for either their income or for their own home?
Oh, absolutely. Long Island Sound is a huge recreational resource. It's also, recreation, and that's an economic driver in and of itself. But it also, there's a lot of commercial activity that rely on the sound being a functioning ecosystem. And when you think about the watershed, the Connecticut River is one of the major contributing rivers to Long Island Sound that delivers clean water to Long Island Sound. And when you think about the size of that watershed, you know, it reaches all the way up to Canada. So that's a whole lot of water that's, that's a very large system that is influencing Long Island Sound, but that is also dependent on this ecosystem of the sound functioning as well.
Right. Interesting. Well, folks, if you're just joining us, we're having a conversation about the environment with Amanda Basso. She's director of the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation in the Northeast region. Her organization, along with others contributing to the Long Island Sound Futures Fund and the recent announcement of 22 grants totaling more than about $1.4 million to local governments and community groups in Connecticut and New York to improve the health and ecosystem of Long Island Sound. So, Amanda, in the second half of our chat this morning, let's start focusing in on a couple of these projects. Are any of them a continuum that where you've granted before and you're continuing to grant now as you're seeing success in building the program, or are all these grants, at least in Connecticut, for brand new projects?
There are some continuing ones. One of my favorites, and of course I love them all, but there's a grant to the National Audubon Society in Audubon, Connecticut, a $35,000 grant that's focusing in New Haven and Stamford that is expanding their schoolyard habitat program, and this is their program where they actually, you know, work with kids to build wildlife habitat on school grounds. In this case, they're doing that work at 13 schools, but then there's an entire curriculum that involves teacher training and hands-on education with the kids, and that's an expansion of that program. So they're adding 3 new schools this year, but they had already been working with 10, and those projects are so important for, you know, I mean, it's hard to imagine, but they're actually very impactful in terms of wildlife habitat. And I think that those of us who live in the big cities like I do, we sometimes forget that those little pockets of habitat in the urban places are important for things like migratory songbirds and for bees and butterflies and other pollinators that, you know, those little stopover places actually are really important in terms of the conservation, but then you also just can't understate the importance of building that conservation stewardship ethic in the kids and having them engage in that work hands-on in their school and then see the migratory songbirds and the bees and the butterflies come and actually occupy that habitat is really impactful as well in terms of, you know, building that next generation of conservationists.
Yeah, you also mentioned, and we talk a lot on this program about stormwater and non-point source pollution and the issues that it's caused and continues to cause in Long Island Sound. So with that in mind and continuing with the inspiration of our young people, the New Haven Urban Resources Initiative applied for and received, I'm not sure if it's $104,000 or close to $200,000 for the New Hallville neighborhood in New Haven to develop a tool to optimize site selection and to train community members to install and maintain green bioswales. Let's talk a little bit about that. That's, first of all, a pretty substantial amount of money, and it sounds like this single project could have a massive impact on the water quality going back into the Sound from the greater New Haven area.
Yeah, yeah, this is a great project as well, and this is a classic case of teach a man to fish. You know, it's a project that is building the capacity in the community to really take on the challenge of managing urban stormwater and the pollution that is in urban stormwater themselves. So it's kind of the grant that we'll keep on giving. The project is going to train community members to, as you say, prioritize and actually find the best locations to put in essentially green infrastructure projects. And that, we say bioswales, those are really rain gardens is another word that sort of describes what those projects are, to site them in the best places to get the most water quality benefit out of them, and then train a range of different sectors of the community to actually do the installation, to do the maintenance of those projects. And so it's also really a green jobs program, and they're going to be putting in about 200 of these bioswales. And it includes working with students from Yale, a bunch of high school students. They're actually working with some ex-offenders in this kind of a green jobs training program. And then a lot of civic groups are engaged so that you're really building the capacity of those civic organizations that already have a mission to care for the community to then be the folks that know how to put these things in the ground, but also to do the maintenance, which is huge. If they're going to continue to deliver the results long after the life of the grant, they have to have that maintenance happening as well.
Great. And it appears, including matching funds, also about another $200,000 or a little bit more going to the to Sacred Heart University down here in Bridgeport for a project in Stratford on Lordship Peninsula. And it's about restoration of onshore habitats, right?
Yeah, it's actually what we call a living shoreline project, and it may sound perfectly intuitive, but that it's a project to restore the natural function of the shoreline there, so that it can absorb the impact of storms and also provide habitat, but also provide that natural water filtration that a functioning shoreline does. A lot of times we've put up walls, we put up rocks and things to hold shores in place, but what that does is it actually stops it from functioning, delivering all of the functions that a natural shoreline can provide in terms of absorbing storm surge and filtering out pollution, and then again, providing habitat for fish and bird species. So that's a really great project. It's going to restore about 28 acres of coastal shoreline habitat at Stratford Point.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting about $148,000 from EPA and the Fish and Wildlife Service in their grant.
Well, that sounds great. Amanda Basso is director of the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation in the Northeast region, and she was talking about just a couple of the 22 projects granted with more than $1.3 million to local government and community groups in Connecticut and New York to improve the health and ecosystem of Long Island Sound through the Long Island Sound Futures Fund. The total goal this year is opening up 7 miles of rivers river for passage of native fish and restoring 180 acres of coastal habitat, including lakes, ponds, and grasslands. This private public grant program pools funds from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, as well as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. Great environmental chat this morning as we move into the new year. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us on the program, and we hope you have a fantastic 2016. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Vayette. I'm John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People, or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab at our radio station website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.